Welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our current podcast project on rethinking sex education. As you know, I try each episode to post thoughts that get a conversation started about creating a viable, helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality. And as always, I thank you for your comments and questions. I try to integrate them into future episodes and also will gather them into the book that this project will become at the end. Now, in this second section of the podcast, we're asking a fundamental question. Does religion have anything to offer our society's current quest for a viable curriculum for sex education for our young people? Now, in these first few episodes of the second section, before we can talk about religion's gift, we're looking at where we've gone wrong, where religion has gone wrong. How is it that we lost our moral authority on the topic? So let's begin this episode, the title of which is Christian Sexuality, Subtle Like Cancer. Now, I said in the last episode that in Western Christianity, we aren't usually overt about our dirty sex instincts anymore. That kind of thinking went out of favor at least 50 years ago. However, the instincts that we saw last time, instincts as old as Clement and Augustine, they don't go away easily. More commonly, they just go underground. Well, in this episode, we'll look at a few contemporary ways that this ancient dirty sex narrative keeps cropping up. Now, several people are helping me think about this project. Some are doing anecdotal research with me, asking their friends all kinds of uncomfortable questions about sex. And after the last episode, one of the folks working through the project with me said, "Now, no way, Doug. Christian people don't really think that way. Really, they don't." So she started a quick and informal survey with her church lady friends. "You're a Christian," she said. "How do you think about sex? Do you think sex is dirty? You're a Christian. When you teach your kids, do you ever say sex is dirty?" And at first, she got all the right answers. "No, of course not. Sex is not dirty. Sex is beautiful. When married people have sex, it's a wonderful thing. That's the party line in the church." And all of her church lady friends, they all knew the right answers. "So what do you teach your kids?" she asked. "Well, we would never teach our kids that sex is dirty." "Well, except some sex. Some sex is dirty. We would teach that. Back alley sex, yeah, that's dirty. Prostitution and cheap hotel sex, yeah, that's dirty. Desperate women doing dirty things, yeah. Disgusting men taking advantage of women, sure, that's all dirty. But healthy sex, sex in marriage, no, that's not dirty. And then, well, some of the sexual things that married men want to do, I mean, these days, porn depicts women all sexed up, and women don't really think or act that way. So, yeah, that part's dirty. But no, in general, sex isn't dirty." And then after a couple of days, she went back for another chat. And now a little more comfortable with the topic, a new layer was exposed. "So what about masturbation?" she asked. "What do you teach your kids about that?" "Well," they said, "ejaculation is not really a sin unless you can control it. If you can control an ejaculation, then you go ahead and do it. Well, that's a sin." So what they meant was that a wet dream, that's not a sin, but masturbation, yes, that is a sin. "In fact," she said, "I told my boys that masturbation makes God cry." But even so, the party line was dirty. No, that's not really the right word. You know what? Sinful. Sinful. That's a better word. So as the conversation continued, maybe gross. Maybe that's a better word. I mean, when they ejaculate all over, ooh, that's just such a filthy mess, and I don't want to touch that stuff. And as the conversation shifted from boys masturbating to ejaculating in general, well, it's all kind of gross, actually. All that stuff getting all over everything, getting inside everything, it's just, ooh. I mean, really, we already have our kids. I don't know why he still insists on coming after me with that thing. So after a couple of weeks talking about it with her church lady friends, my research helper's takeaway insights was this. First, if you just bring up the subject, sexuality, you step out of normal Christian group dynamics. Church ladies just don't talk about the subject. When she started talking about it, she provoked more than a little bit of nervous laughter. She told me it felt like she'd violated some unspoken rule that proper people, maybe proper Christian people, maybe proper Christian women, just don't talk about the subject. Second, she evoked an unspoken, maybe a little bit subterranean, defense posture. She got a couple of reprimands for deviating from clinical language when she didn't talk about the parts as penises or vaginas, but when she used colloquial language. Anytime the conversation ventured outside of prescribed Christian sex norms, she evoked the response that this kind of stuff just doesn't happen in our house. Which might be true, she said, that nobody in those houses deviates from accepted norms. But if they do, or if they don't, it's definitely an unspoken rule. We don't talk about it. And so her quick and informal survey doesn't surprise me, because I've been in the church all my life. I know not everybody's that way, but there are a lot who are. And I know what she says, that is the way that many, and maybe even most, Christian people think about or speak about sex. On the surface, we've been taught that it's good and that it's a beautiful part of life, but under the surface, those ancient instincts, they still influence us. Under the surface, we are still affected by the dirty sex Christian narrative. But now it's a subtle influence. But when I say subtle, I say subtle like cancer is subtle. Cancer doesn't show on the surface, but its hiddenness actually makes it all the more dangerous, because it works on us sight unseen. It works on us under the surface, and these ancient toxic instincts are killing us. Now, in this episode, I'm going to give three contemporary examples of the way those ancient instincts are still cropping up today. Still today, long after the teachings of Clement and Alexandria have fallen out of favor, dirty sex is still affecting us. So the first example, it's masturbation. But it's really not masturbation. So it's about a preacher I heard a few years ago teaching about masturbation. His was the view that masturbation is a sin. And I suspect he was getting some pushback on the point because he was working really hard to make a convincing case, which is tough for a preacher to do, by the way, because you have to do some pretty creative misinterpreting to get the Bible to say that masturbation is a sin. We'll cover more of that in part three when we actually get to the practical questions about sexuality. But this preacher, with very little evidence from the Bible, was working hard to make the case that masturbation is a sin, and this was his proof. Every young boy who masturbates, he said, feels guilt when he does. And that is the proof he needed. There's something deep inside of us, he insisted, that inherently knows it is bad to masturbate. Something deep inside of us inherently knows that masturbation is wrong, so we feel guilty when we do it. Now, when I heard that sermon, I was much younger than I am, and I wasn't thinking much about how the early church history has affected us. But now, reflecting back, I feel really bad for the people who heard that sermon. Because whether he knew about Christian history or not, here's what he was saying. Christianity moved west into a Greek anti-physicality worldview. Early Christians contorted the Hebrew worldview of Paul and Jesus in the scriptures to make it fit in the new worldview. A byproduct of that contorting was a deep sense that sex is dirty. So generation after generation, we have taught our young people that their sexuality is sinful and dirty and bad, and they in turn have taught their children the same. And now, saturated in centuries of this teaching, a 12-year-old boy awakens to his physical desire, he awakens to his sex drive, awakens to his hormones, and he discovers masturbation. And after 1,800 years of this religious culture insisting that that awakening is somehow dirty, he feels guilty. And there, no further evidence required, that's the proof we need. This child, who we spent considerable energy teaching to feel guilty, now feels guilty. Now, no matter what we say about masturbation when we get to part three, that seems like a pretty flawed argument. It seems like a pretty flawed system, and it seems pretty influenced by dirty sex instincts. If we're going to make the same argument about a non-sexual topic, we would call foul. We would point out how circular the reasoning is. So yes, even though our dirty sex instincts have gone underground, they're still at work. They're still functioning. They're still plaguing us. A second example. Let's talk about the Christian idea of modesty. When dirty sex sneaks into Christian thinking today, it's harder on our young women than it is on our young men, which shouldn't surprise us given what we learned last time about the early shaping forces on our Christian instincts. I was reading about a clever marketing strategy for church youth groups. It's an attempt to get our young girls to dress modestly. It's a curriculum and a catchphrase, and it's this: modest is hottest. Now, the Bible does talk about dressing modestly in both 1 Timothy and 1 Peter, and I think most parents agree that modest dress is a good thing. It's hard because sometimes the mall only carries short shorts, but a lot of parents teach their kids that not much good happens when we send a message with our clothing that offers easy sexual access. So, what could be wrong with marketing a good idea to our teens in a clever way, modest is hottest? But a quick look under the surface of the marketing strategy, and there it is again. Our long-standing, our toxic way of thinking. There it is again, dirty sex sneaking in on us. And there it is again, the age-old idea that women's sex is the dirtiest kind of sex. So there was an article in Christianity Today back in 2011. You can Google the title. It's called, How Modest is Hottest is Hurting Christian Women. Now in the article, the author argues that the way we Christians talk about modesty, rather than challenging our culture's objectification of women, actually reinforces it. We teach our young girls that they should cover their bodies as a spiritual discipline, as a spiritual practice to be pleasing to God. A young girl should not show too much skin or show too much of her womanly shape because to do so, we teach them, is to, quote, cause the brothers to stumble. That's the way we say it. You will cause the brothers to stumble. The brothers, we tell our young girls, can't be around a female body without sin jumping right into their hearts. Now, the unspoken subtext beneath the message takes us all the way back to Clement of Alexandria. Our unspoken instincts stubbornly keep on insisting that female sexuality, the female body, is first and foremost a portal into sin. It is first and foremost a danger to the Christian life. Sure, the female body is beautiful, but it is dangerous. I mean, look what happened to Adam. So covertly, the modest is hottest strategy is rooted in shame. It tells our young girls in a backhanded way that there's something wrong with their bodies, that there is something bad about the female body. So, we tell them, don't let too much of your body be seen, it will ruin the world. Don't let too much of your body be seen, it will corrupt healthy Christian community. Now here's the thing. Television and entertainment and weight loss companies and the porn industry are all working on the same basic assumptions as modest is hottest. Each one treats the female body as an object. In our culture today, when we think about the female body, we focus very little on the person who lives in that female body. It's not the woman who comes with the body, it's her body and all of its breastiness and all of its hippiness and all of its sexy, curvy parts. That's how marketers and pornographers approach the female body. The woman is defined as the body she comes in, the object. A woman's body is the main feature of her identity. It is her body. It is how she looks. And the body that identifies her is a visually arousing object, a powerfully arousing object, so powerful that we make billions of dollars with that object. That's how marketers and pornographers think about the female body. But in a sneaky way, it is the same subtextual way that the Christian message of modesty thinks about the female body. Neither side celebrates a woman's body as a glorious reflection of God's creation. No, it is a source of temptation. For one group, it causes the brothers to stumble. For the other group, it causes the brothers to fork over a bundle of cash. As perverse as it sounds, they're saying the same thing. The only difference is that youth leaders want to protect the brothers, and marketers and pornographers want to fleece the brothers. But neither one is focused on the woman inside the body. They're focused on the brothers. Pornographers want to put the object on display. Youth leaders want to keep it hidden away. But either way, the female body is the object and the brothers are the focus. Both extremes share the same basic view. Both sides reduce the female body to a dirty sexual object. There they are, those ancient dirty sex instincts. They keep coming back. They don't serve us well. They get us into all kinds of trouble. And again, if we Christians want to contribute to the healthy sex education curriculum, if we want to give the wisdom gift of our tradition, we're going to have to come to grips with how we have lost our way and how our lostness still impacts us. Deep in our Christian sexual consciousness, there are lingering instincts of shame around sexuality. Even though our dirty sex instincts have gone underground, they're still plaguing us. One last example. Let's talk about how we use the word purity. In Christian sex education, we often use that word, purity. It's a really nice sounding word, pure. It evokes images of water that is healthy and free of infection. It evokes images of food with simple, wholesome ingredients. It makes us think about rivers and woods and all these places that are free of industrial pollutants. It's a nice sounding word. So we Christians, we spend a lot of energy teaching our children to remain pure, by which we mean don't have sex until they get married. But when we don't define very clearly what actually is impure about sex, we create some trouble. So in our youth groups, when we institute purity rituals, or we give out purity rings, or we hold purity retreats, we are implying that there is something impure about sex. The word that we chose to train our young people carries a flip side meaning which doesn't seem to bother us. We did not choose the word healthy sexuality or soul nourishing sexuality or beneficial or sustainable or timeliness or informed sexuality. We didn't choose words like holistic or the full sexual experience. No, we chose a binary distinction between pure or impure. And in our word choice, we reveal how our basic instincts are still rooted way back in the second century distortion of the faith. Sex is still dirty, even though we don't say it out loud anymore. Now, we see this really clearly when we speak to our young people about virginity, because the words purity and virginity are usually traveling companions. Virginity is kind of the gold standard of purity. It implies that non-virginity is non-purity, and the two concepts kind of bleed into one another. So the way that we think about virginity was hammered out at a time when patriarchy dominated societies. When we speak of virginity, we can't help but carry themes from the past when virginity was framed in terms of property rights. We formed our ideas about virginal purity at the same time women were practically owned by men. Women were owned, first by their fathers, later by their husbands. And when we don't, and even though we don't speak of virginity in these terms anymore, those underlying values are still in there, still affecting us. So if you grew up in a church culture that stressed purity or virginity, so take a moment now and look inside your own gut instincts. Odds are you will find there a view that the virginity of a young man is different than the virginity of a young woman. For young men, many picked up the instinct that boys will be boys. For young women, however, things are a little harsher. Young women are either virginal or easy, virginal or slutty. So where did these unspoken instincts come from? They came from Clement, and they got broadcast by Augustine. And a patriarchal system that influenced how our religion taught us about women and property and sexuality, that's where it came from. And here we are all these years later, still influenced by them. Here are those ideas still sneaking in when we teach our young people about purity. In our male-dominated past, being sexually active was like buying a new car. When a car is still on the lot, it holds top dollar value. Driven even 10 feet off the lot, and now it's diminished in value. A virginal woman was more of a valuable commodity. A non-virginal woman had her worth, her value, dropped considerably. Now, when you hear it put this way, I don't suppose many people think that those subconscious instincts are very healthy at all. I imagine some of us would even dispute that we hold them. But I can't tell you how many young Christians I've spoken to through the years whose deep sense of personal worth and value has been achingly degraded in their own eyes because they were getting it on in the back seat some Friday night. Sadly, there is a whole surgical industry out there to restore physical virginity to a woman. It's a cosmetic procedure to repair a broken hymen. One website that advertises this procedure put this on their website. By using various surgical techniques, we can repair the hymen and restore a virginal condition. The symbolic importance of the hymen is related to a girl's position within a social category. A girl with a hymen is still gender neutral. Without it, she becomes a generic being. Non-participation in hymen repair can have far-reaching implications for the girl and her family. That's a real thing. And that's not a real thing in some developing nation, but right here in contemporary Western culture among Christian people, it's a thing. I couldn't believe it when I read that. Now, it's a thing in no small part because of our own ancient and unexamined and unspoken instincts and how they keep creeping in. Now, to be sure, it's an extreme version but most people would find hymen repair off-putting. They would see the extremity of it. Well, if we already think that, imagine how people outside the church think about it. They would put it in the same category as genital mutilation, something barbaric, backward people would do to their women. So sure, it's extreme. And sure, not all Christians think that way, but some do. And they think that way for historical reasons. And by looking at the extreme, we kind of see the instincts that are inside of us. Because even though we wouldn't condone the extreme expression of the idea, many of us still hold the idea. And so no wonder the church is ignored. These unspoken assumptions, they keep cropping up with such toxic effect that we don't get a place at the table when the sex ed curriculum is being crafted. Now again, to be fair, most Christians today recoil at the idea of women at property as property. Most recoil from the idea of a woman's value being measured by her virginity. But that's not really the point. The extremes point out the instincts that drive the extremes. So even if we don't go to the extreme, we do teach our children about purity and don't even pay attention to the flip side of that word, which is impurity. We don't talk about the word healthy. And when we do these things, those same assumptions that take us to the extremes are sneaking into our lives and deeply shaping how we think. I've seen it in the church for years. Dirty sex hasn't gone away. Just like the church ladies that we began with. We don't say it out loud anymore, but there it is, quietly shaping our instincts and shaping how we teach our young, shaping how we draw lines of right and wrong, good and bad, healthy and unhealthy. And more often than not, the outcome is more harmful than helpful, more unhealthy than healthy. What we're doing hasn't been working. How we've been teaching our young hasn't been working. The instincts that we bring to sex education haven't been helping. That dirty sex has gone underground, that doesn't matter. That our ancient instincts are more subtle actually makes them worse, cancer worse. Bad instincts are bad instincts. Untrue truths are untrue. It doesn't matter how we tidy them up. It doesn't matter how we fool ourselves into thinking they're not there. Bad instincts are bad instincts. And our history is infected with them, which is going to require some courageous and fearless self-examination. We'll have to look at how our past has affected us, how our most basic instincts and intuitions need some rethinking. All right, well, we'll pick up here next time. And as always, I hope you'll join in. Has your experience of religious sex education had the hint of dirtiness? I really would like to hear your stories. You can either post on the Facebook page or on the website directly. I'd love to hear you.